The Recap Show is an unfiltered inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports and all things culture. From two U.S. Women's National Team World Cup champions and Olympians, follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring in our man, James Hamm here, kind enough to join us here an hour early. Some appointments he's got going on today. Hammer, I just posed the question, like, we've allowed ourselves to fall in love during Summer League, and that can be dangerous. Falling in love can hurt. And we have fallen in love so many times, and we have had our heart broken so many times. But right now, it feels like people have fallen in love with Maxine Renault, with Neek Clifford, and we are just holding on to the start of training camp to see where this new relationship might take us.
No, I'm with you. I mean, for me, watching Neek Clifford play, like, you just keep upping the player comp. Like, every time you watch him, you're like, oh, he's got that in his bag? In this game, he's got 12 points or something like that, but 8 assists, 5 rebounds. Mm-hmm. Like, everything he's doing is something that is repeatable at the next level. And when the spacing is better and when he's a fourth or fifth option on the court, you can just see how much better he's going to look when he's not the focal point of the other team. So I think everybody has, watching him play, everybody should be pretty excited just because the confidence, everything that he does, again, just looks like an NBA player. And that's a good sign. Renault, he's going to have ups and downs. He needs to get way stronger. You can see that. He needs to be better at rebounding, better finding a body as a rebounder. But overall, I think, we're watching like the early stages of two guys who should be in the Kings rotation at least by midseason. And with Neek, I would say on day one.
You're a little more, maybe skeptical is the wrong term, but are you a little more, it sounds like you're a little more reserved with Maxime Renault.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just being realistic. I mean, he's going to have some good moments, but he's also going to have some moments where it's like, look, you either have to be bigger, stronger than everybody around you, or as a big man, you got to be real quick. Mm-hmm. And he's caught in between those two things right now. And I think, the next, 8 to 10 weeks is going to be super important for him to grow and learn and get better. And the Kings, they'll have a plan for him coming out of Summer League. But I do think that, again, bringing in a guy like Drew Eubanks to compete for minutes with him, that's a good thing. Bringing in a guy like Dario Saric, if he makes a team, whatever, if he's going to be there, like having these guys there to compete with him for minutes, it opens a door where it might not be the first week of the season or the first month of the season, but there could very well come a point where you see some of those back looks like a player who, first is really, really smart. I mean, they were talking to him on the broadcast a few minutes ago while you were on the air, and he's a computer science and math major at Stanford, so that tells you he's a really brilliant dude. But yeah, he's yelling, he's screaming, he's on top of his teammates early on, and I think that's great too. You just want him to be able to maintain that when he's with the parent club and he's getting minutes. He's got to be able to be a leader from the back line.
We talked a few minutes ago, Keegan Murray came up in a conversation with Chris Biederman earlier, Hammer, and one of the things I think when you look back at Keegan Murray's rookie season, which was really good, there were a lot more ups than downs. He was as steady of a rookie as I think maybe we've ever seen in Sacramento. And I attribute part of that to being he had a very clearly defined role from the moment he stepped on the floor. Like, I know he didn't start the very first game. Maybe he started the second one that he played or whatever it was. But, like, he had a very, very clearly defined role. And I think that played a part in the way that rookie season went. I'm fearful that neither Neek, or I'm positive James is frozen, right? Like, I just continue to talk. Like James is, I think James is going from moments of freezing.
James is doing a commercial right now.
Okay, as long as James hears me, that's fine. One of my concerns, Hammer, with Neek and Max both is, while I think both of those guys have roles with this Sacramento Kings team, I don't know how clearly defined that they are. I think that's something both of those guys have to work through. That's something that Doug Christie and his coaching staff have to work through. And that, to me, creates a situation where you probably have a little bit more ups and downs here in this rookie season for those guys.
No, I mean, it's a really good point, you know, but I would actually look at the role that Keegan had in his rookie season. And why can't that be a role that we see starting lineup most likely, but I still see that as like that can be his role. Keep it simple and then slowly build from there. I actually think because of his age, because of his years of college, you know, just Keegan came in as an older rookie as well, but like a 21-year-old rookie, but with only 2 years of college experience. Neek comes in with 5 years of college experience. Like, it's not just that he's 23. I said he's 23 with, you know, 160 games or something under his belt. It's something crazy. So you're expecting him to be taking it to be able to take on more at a younger age, as far as, you know, like whether it's defensive questions or whether it's, you know, hey, we need you to be a little bit more of a distributor. I think just naturally he's a great rebounder for his position. He'll be able to do that. I think he'll be able to hold his own defensively at the small forward or at the shooting guard. And to be honest, I think he could average 10 points a game as a rookie. You know, getting above that as a rookie coming off the bench where he's likely going to be won't be the easiest thing to do. But I do think that there's plenty of room for him to grow and to know what his role is, but to slowly be able to take on more and more. And the one thing I'll say is that a lot of times when you see rookies who try to do too much, you see it right away. Like, but when I'm watching Neek Clifford play, it doesn't feel like anything he does is too much. It feels like he's playing within the confines in the flow of the offense, the flow of the defense. Like, he's just playing basketball. And that's a good sign for the Kings, because when a player, you know, again, looks like they're doing too much and you can see it right away and, you know, forcing the issues, which a lot of, you know, again, not to single out Devin, but a lot of, I just watched him throw up an air ball on a step back three. Like, man, you're doing too much, you know, like, yeah. Let the game come to you. And Clifford, even though it's like his fourth summer league game, you see this like calmness and ease to his game. That, you know, again, I think we've seen from certain rookies throughout the years with the Kings. You know, Keegan certainly had that calmness, that maturity as a rookie. But also, you know, like, look at Tyreke Evans. He was phenomenal as a rookie. You know, he clearly, but again, he was doing too much a lot of the time. But you still understood how good he was, like, right away. I think we're going to, like, the legend of Neek Clifford is going to grow here. And I think he's going to be a really, really solid rotational player, maybe even the starter down the road.
Yeah, Neek is doing that thing again. He's having a big quarter, and he's up to 19 points to go along with those 8 assists that you referenced when we started this conversation. He's at 19, 5 rebounds, 8 assists, 1 turnover for Neek on 8 of 14 shooting, man, in his 28 minutes. And the Sacramento Kings are up 6 with 2 minutes and 53 seconds left. One thing, you talked about the conversation with Max earlier, Hammer. One thing Kings fans got really excited about was he's talking about, nah, let's go win Summer League. Like, we're here. He's just, you guys shutting down. That's fine. Let's go win Summer League. And I think Kings fans will always love and appreciate that level of competitiveness and fire above virtually anything else.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, Doug is going to appreciate it.
Like, oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Doug is over the moon excited about the way his team is playing right now. And it's not whether they're hitting shots or not. Everybody loves the fact that the Kings came in shooting like 42% from three, and Neek Clifford came in shooting 70% from three in the first three games. Mm-hmm. That's not sustainable, I don't think.
Well,
but
who knows?
But it's the style of play and the grit that they're playing on defense, where everyone is just talking about how well they're playing defensively. And that's something that Doug is hoping to, that will carry over. You know, these guys aren't going to get to play this type of minutes ever in this season. You know, there might be a couple of games where Devin Carter or Isaac Jones or Nate Clifford play, you know, heavy minutes. But as a group, this group, you're not going to expect them to play this type of, you know, like time on the court together. But that doesn't change the fact that they're going to be in Sacramento. They're going to be playing against each other. They're going to be battling all through the next 10 weeks, building up to training camp. And in that time, when the veterans do come in, they're gonna see the level of play from these guys and the intensity that they're playing with. And if guys aren't playing to that intensity, they're not going to play. Mm-hmm. They're going to get pushed to the side. If you don't want to play what Doug is, you know, trying to build, this culture of strong physicality, you know, defense, talking, hoisting up threes, but also, you know, the beautiful game that Doug always talks about, sharing is caring. All of that stuff. If you're not willing to do that, you're going to find yourself out of the rotation really quickly. And I think that that's, you know, they're trying to establish a culture that's unique to Sacramento, unique to Doug Christie, but, you know, that mirrors some of the cultures you see around the league, whether it's, you know, the Houston Rockets who play extremely hard, the Memphis Grizzlies who play extremely hard, like those teams that don't give in and make you play a full 48. And that's something that you can establish in the summer league, that you can carry over in the build up to training camp and then into training camp. I'd also say they're pushing the ball a lot. Mm-hmm. And they're also grabbing rebounds and shooting out long outlet passes. That's not something we've seen from this Kings team since, you know, the Dave Yeager second year, where they had the fastest team in the league for about 85% of the season until they slowed down at the end. I expect this team to run. And so maybe Doug is a coach that is willing to go, you know, 9 or 10 deep and not limit his rotation like Mike was always wary of doing.
And that's kind of another component to this upcoming Kings season that a lot of us are asking questions about, is we don't know exactly what type of coach Doug Christie is. I don't know if Doug knows exactly what type of coach he is. Last year, you know, he did a fantastic job, but last year was surviving. It wasn't about mm-hmm. finding your style. It wasn't about doing, like, Doug was surviving thing after thing after thing. First, it's taking over from Mike Brown, trying to figure out how to get that team on track after losing 6 straight. He loses his first. It's 7 straight, and then they're able to get going. Actually, I think his loss was the 6 straight. Then they won, you know, 7 in a row. I think it was 10 of 11 or 11 of 12 or something like that. Then you have the whole De'Aaron Fox situation. Then you try to integrate Zach LaVine, and he's dealing with so much. I don't know that he ever had the opportunity to find out who exactly he is as a head coach. Just as much as these players have an opportunity, you know, this offseason to kind of grow together, gel together, work out together, you know, refine their games, Doug has the opportunity to find out exactly what he wants to do as a head coach. And you mentioned seeing things that we haven't seen, you know, in terms of ball movement, in terms of pace since Dave Yeager was here. It'll be interesting to see how much of that hammer DC takes with him into the start of the season.
Yeah, I will tell you this. Doug never understood why they slowed it down.
Yeah.
Like, never understood, like, why you have a Ferrari as a point guard and you got him in third gear the whole mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. Like, it was frustrating, like, as Doug was a commentator, well, an analyst while he was watching the games and stuff. You know, again, I spent a lot of time with Doug sitting, watching games together, and his prevailing thought was always like, why are they not pushing the tempo? I'm intrigued too to see what kind of, because what we're talking about is, you know, again, Doug said it so many times last year, he was trying to like fix an airplane while it's in the air, mm-hmm. like trying to keep the airplane, you know, in the air while flying to the next destination mm-hmm. and not having the thing crash and burn. And I think that there is something, you know, like to being a leader of men, sort of what he did to keep the thing on the right path. But I totally agree with you when we don't know what Doug's like offensive identity is going to what his full-fledged defensive identity is going to be. It's one thing to say they're going to play hard, they're going to play physical, they're going to give second and third efforts and all that stuff, but are they going to be like, are they going to have a horns offense that, you know, super heavy on the pick and roll? Are they going to have a slow offense? I will tell you, Doug, he was really, really close with Pete Carril. Mm-hmm. And like for years, but they kept in touch for, you know, until Pete Carril passed away a few years ago. They were always, always super close. And they talked all the time about the ideas of basketball. And so a lot of what you get from Doug, like when you do talk to him about it, it's almost like basketball abstract. It's thinking about the game and how the flow of the game should be, how you know, how you should be with your teammates, the type of screen that you should set, you know, how to roll to it the right way, all of these little finer nuances of the game, which he's really, really like, that's something that he pushes on players so much. Mm-hmm. You know, like the idea, Pete Carril told him, you know, they worked on behind the back passes and people are like, why are we doing all these behind the back passes? He's like, well, because sometimes a behind the back pass is the right pass. Like you're able to shield your body, shield the defender away from the ball, go behind your back and open up a running lane to a player that you can't do while you're facing the other way. And so there's all of these nuances to the game, but how does that work within the structure of an offense, the structure of a defense, and what is Doug going to be known as? What type of, you know, sort of, again, offense are they going to run? Will it look like what we saw from Mike Brown's offense, which was realistically Jay Triano's offense, or will it look like something more from, you know, his time with Rick Adelman and sort of the Princeton style with the high posts? Like, we don't know yet, and we're going to have to wait and see what that looks like.
And Doug may not know either, but I think the true hallmark of a great coach is Doug may have an idea of what he wants to do as a head coach and how he wants his team to play. But you've got to cater that to your roster. Like you talked about Doug, the analyst, you know, referencing those teams. Like, I don't understand why, you know, you've got a Ferrari and you got him in third gear this whole time. Why did you stop moving? You don't have the Ferrari anymore. Like, you have a different type of team. You have DeMar DeRozan. You have Zach LaVine. Everyone talked last year about, you know, Doug would talk openly about how many threes he wanted the Sacramento Kings to shoot. And Kings fans would be like, well, you're never going to hit that number because you got DeMar DeRozan there. You're only going to get, you know, two, maybe three from Domantas Sabonis on a game-to-game basis. So the hallmark of a great coach is having an idea of what you want to do, then recognizing I might not have the roster that can execute that, and then adjusting. And Doug might have to build his first-year coaching style off of what exactly he could do with this roster.
Yeah, it's kind of a bummer, though, because you would hope that they would be able to adjust the roster accordingly to get the players that might fit like some sort of flow offense. So then that way, you know, when they do make changes, it doesn't feel so dramatic, because I think that's the one thing, like everyone knows, like there's nothing wrong with what DeMar DeRozan does as a player. I mean, he's efficient. He's incredible. He's going in the Hall of Fame, you know, six-time All-Star, top 25 all-time scoring list. Like what he does is really spectacular. And there are games where, you know, the Kings would have lost by 20 without DeMar DeRozan. But at the same time, you have to, you know, see what his impact is on the rest of the players, and how do you build a team around that, and how do you limit sort of the DeMar DeRozan effect? Because again, you have DeMar for one season, and maybe if you want him for a second season, but at that point he's going to be 37 years old and might not want to play basketball anymore. And so how do you design a team around players that may or may not be there? How do you design a team around one of the best passing big men in the NBA with the understanding that there may come a point where Domantas Sabonis isn't on this team? Mm-hmm. And so it's a constant battle to develop your own identity as a coach, play to the strengths of your players, like what you're talking about, but also find the players that fit the system so you can succeed in the style of play that you want to play. And I think it's going to be a constant battle until they sort of get this roster, not just right, but on the right path. And I think that's what most of us have been asking for. It's not that you go out there and have, you know, again, the Clippers roster where you have, you know, five all-stars or six all-stars in your rotation. Mm-hmm. It's about getting a player that makes sense for what you're trying to do as a team. And that's all, you know, I think all of us, we weren't sitting here pining for them to go get, you know, the best player, even Mikal Bridges, like, right. Everyone would have loved Mikal Bridges, but it was with the understanding that going out and getting Mikal Bridges costs you five first round picks. You know, it's more like, hey, you know, this Cam Johnson kid fits the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he knows how to play the position. He might not be as good as a Mikal Bridges or an OG Anunoby, but he's still the type of player that this team needs. And I think that that's where, you know, it's tough for Scott because he's got a lot of cleanup to do and he's got to figure out how to bring in these pieces that were never quite brought in to finish off the original roster. And now the roster is going to be completely different because you traded away the best player. And so now you're rebalancing the entire time, trying to figure out a way through like a very, very dicey situation.
Shout out to the Kings and Cavs who stretched that final 2 minutes to last as long as humanly possible. The game has finally gone final. The Sacramento Kings win their fourth straight summer league game. They are 4-0, beating the Cleveland Cavaliers 94-86. Neat Clifford winds up finishing with 19 points, 7 rebounds, and 9 assists. Maxine Reynaud finished with 10 points in his 23 minutes of play. Isaac Jones finished with 17 points. And Devin Carter, 11 points, 6 assists. Devin and Max led the team with 4 turnovers. I don't want to be overly negative. I thought Devin stunk today, man. And maybe it doesn't matter. I don't know. Devin Carter is not this team's backup point guard. He's not this team's emergency point guard. He's not this team's point guard in any way, shape, or form. I don't know what he is here to do for the Sacramento Kings team, but I know it is not that.
Yeah, I mean, it's so tough watching him. You know, Kyle and I were discussing this earlier. The question was, like, who was it? Who were we hoping would have a better game or that would, you know, sort of come out of this looking like, you know, the better player type deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it, between Devin and Neek. And I, you know, like, I want to see which one of them takes over as a point guard, which one of them gets in the pick and roll, which one of them finds their teammates in the corner and, or sets up the big man for the dunk, you know, which one, like, has that it factor as a potential, you know, like, not primary distributor, but a distributor. And what did Devin finish assist-wise for the game?
He finished with 6 assists in this one. 6 assists, 4 turnovers.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that 4 of those assists came on lead passes to a guy who was cherry-picking. Mm-hmm. And that's okay. You know, because you need that as well, but that doesn't say primary ball handler. That says, like, grab a rebound, which he's a great rebounder for his size, grab the rebound, hit a lead pass, and go from there. That's really a good attribute to have. But when you saw Neat Clifford finish with 9, and they're all kinds of different assists, it's finding guys under the basket, it's finding guys in the corner, it's finding guys in the pick and roll, you know, the lob to Reynaud. Like all of those things, they show you that he can be a primary ball handler in a pinch.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the step we were hoping that Devin Carter would take somewhere along the way in this summer league. But it's also where you see that his natural instincts have nothing to do with being a point guard. And again, he can throw a...
I'm Kristen Press.
And I'm Tobin Heath.
We're World Cup winners, Olympians, and the hosts of The Recap Show.
Every week, we sit down with the icons, disruptors, and game changers on the field and beyond it to talk victories, heartbreaks, and everything in between.
We've built a space where athletes, change makers, and people creating the future of women's sports can show up and show off as their full, unapologetic selves. Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
A bomb outlet pass that, you know, drops from the ceiling like his three-point shot and looks really good, but where are you at in a basic offensive set? And when you get to the key, do you have any idea what you're doing, or are you just getting to the key and then pivoting on one foot the whole time? And I know he did have a nice find. He found Isaac Jones for a dunk at one point, but it's just the consistency of it. You know, his head isn't up as a player. His head is down because he wants to score for himself. And I told Kyle this the other day, like I think he's a lot more Cam Thomas than he is, you know, any kind of point guard. And, you know, again, those types of players like that, they end up getting assists, but they end up getting assists because, you know, two guys shift over to him because they keep chucking and they know that they're not going to pass. And then all of a sudden they hit a pass that, you know, finds a guy that's wide open. So it should be interesting to see what happens. But, you know, I definitely think we've seen Neat Clifford consistently put up 18, you know, finish like he's averaging 18.3 points per game. He's got like between 17 and like 21 points every game. There is no fluctuation. His rebound numbers are solid. His assist numbers spiked in this game, but it came in averaging 3.7 assists per game. And all of them are like between 3 and 4 assists per game. So I like the consistency of action and what we're watching on the floor. It matches the stat line perfectly. You see a competent rebound. You see a competent ball handler, a competent distributor of the basketball, and a very confident scorer. And that's all good.
We got more time with James Hamm. He joined us an hour early to talk Summer League basketball, to talk Kings basketball. We'll continue to talk Sacramento Kings 4-0 so far in Summer League. We'll talk more about this game against Cleveland, more about Neek, more about Devin, more about Maxime Renault when Dillon and Casey with James Hamm continue here on Sacramento Sports Leader ESPN 1320. Man, I step out real quick, come back. James is in 4K. Goodness gracious. James is crystal on the screen. Your internet was having a Devin Carter-like day first few minutes of that conversation. But now you look like the Sacramento Kings, who are 4-0 here in this summer league and appear to be attempting to win their third summer league title, man, and why not? What a boost that would be for, you know, one thing that we haven't talked hammer in our excessive praise of guys like Neat Clifford and Maxime Renault is that those guys are the first draft picks of, you know, this new front office with Scott Perry, BJ Armstrong. This new front office, you know, that took over following the season, didn't have a pick leading into the draft, didn't have a first round pick leading into the draft, and, you know, by very, very early appearances, seemed to have landed not one, but two guys who could potentially make an impact on their team. Man, what a feather in the cap that would be for this new front office.
Yeah, I mean, like, look, if you find two rotational players when you had no first round pick and you were able to trade in, that would be huge. I mean, this team needs it, right? The Kings, they lost Jake LaRavia. They lost, well, I mean, at this point, Trey Lyles does not appear to be coming back.
Yeah.
They moved on from Jonas Valanciunas in what amounts to a salary dump. Like, they've lost some depth here, right? And so adding depth pieces, you know, sure, you can try to go out and sign players in free agency. But even like a real basic signing like Drew Eubanks, like that's fine and all, but that's not going to be the difference between you winning like two more games. Like somebody else has to be able to step up. And, you know, again, if Neat Clifford becomes a player who gets 16 to 18 minutes a game as a rookie and starts showing some major promise, it allows you to do something crazy. Like, maybe at the trade deadline, you do move on from a guy like DeMar. Maybe you cash in whatever value that you can get out of him, or you get a player who's under contract longer that makes sense for your roster build. If you feel like he's ascended to a point where you can install him into a lineup. I'd also point out, like we've mentioned this before, but Scott Perry has done some really good work in the history of his drafting in the 20s. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't, has he made some mistakes? Sure. You know, like Kevin Knox, not a great draft pick, but mm-hmm. he also drafted Aaron Gordon in when he was with Orlando. Like, these are players that he's hit like high end of the draft, but also he found Emmanuel Quickly at number 25. You know, and that's what you're kind of hoping, that that he won't turn into Emmanuel Quickly, but that level of player, if you can find that that level of player in the 20s, then you did a great job and your scouting department did a great job. And not only that, but you made a decision that that made sense, because I think a lot of times that's been one of the knocks on the Monty and Wes sort of like their era, was like, why do you keep drafting point guards? Why do you keep drafting undersized players? Mm-hmm. Why do you not address like the elephant in the room? And, you know, just the fact is there was always an elephant in the room. Like, how, why do you not have a 6'8", 6'9"? Why do you have to go out and get a Mo Harkless or a KZ Akpala or a Chimo
Moneki?
Yeah. Why are you going out and getting these players, but not the better versions of those players, you know? And that's tough. I mean, you want to grow your players, and you want to be able to, you know, maybe develop an Isaiah Crawford, Isaac Jones. But at the same time, like, there is a way in which you go get higher end versions of those players, whether it's in the draft or free agency. And they didn't address those situations like time and time again.
Do you think the Kings tried to, because it felt like, I don't know, 6 weeks ago, we actually would regularly through the offseason kind of have fun with this question. Like, is it a foregone conclusion that the Sacramento Kings are trading DeMar DeRozan? Is it a foregone conclusion that DeMar DeRozan is playing somewhere else other than Sacramento? And the answer for months and months and months and months and months was, yeah, like, he's not. Like, yeah, it doesn't fit. Yeah, for a multitude of reasons, he's not going to be here. And it wasn't even, at least not for me, it wasn't even like a slow, gradual change into, hey, I think DeMar is going to be here. It just suddenly hit me that, yeah, maybe they're not trading him. Maybe he is going to be here. Now, this was all before we saw the current climate that's happening in the NBA, this really weird offseason that we're having. But do you think that the Sacramento Kings tried to trade DeMar or weren't interested in trading DeMar?
Like, look, I think, like, I heard stuff early in the offseason about the Miami Heat. But then, you know, it feels like Scott came in the door, and we've all heard about this. Like, he went around and interviewed everyone in the building, like, you know, everyone from, you know, locker room attendants to, you know, like, security people and everything else. He like wanted to get a lay of the land. And I think it, as part of that, I think that there were conversations with DeMar, and, you know, for whatever reason, they've decided that their path forward is together, at least for right now. And maybe that's because there wasn't a big robust market for DeMar DeRozan, at least at this point. But I certainly could see there being a robust market for DeMar like midseason. Mm. The problem is you're always going to need to, like, the Kings can't just trade DeMar just to trade him. You know, he averaged 22 points per game last season.
Right.
Like, he's a ball player.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're going to trade him, you better go get an asset for him. Mm-hmm. You better get something for him. Or, you know, is there more value in having your salary drop by $26 million next season? Mm-hmm. Or $16 million bucks next season and completely clear the year after? Because I think that that can be the advantage too here, where you can sit here and continuously switch out players and hope that for the best, or you can leave players in place and, you know, if you're not going to get actual value for them on the trade market, or you're going to hurt yourself further with additional years of bad contracts from some other player on a different team, you might just want to hold tight and let this thing play out and try to be as competitive as possible in the meantime, which is kind of where we're at. But you're right. Like, the switch was weird. Yeah. Like, all of a sudden, it's just like DeMar's not part of any trade conversation. and Scott Perry likes him a lot, and it sounds like DeMar's sticking around.
Yeah, for me, it was thinking about Scott Perry and the types of players it appears that he likes. I started to think, I feel like that's DeMar. Like, I feel like DeMar fits the mold of what Scott Perry would like in a basketball player. Obviously, DeMar is tremendously well-respected across the league, so I'm sure that plays a part in it. But, and you mentioned something there a second ago. Can you walk me through this? Because I'm pretty sure I got it. DeMar's contract is only partially guaranteed next year, which means if the Sacramento Kings don't trade him or can't trade him, they can waive him and would only owe a partial amount of that guarantee. Or yeah, a partial amount of that contract, I should say.
There was a way in which he could get the entirety guaranteed, but I don't think, or the guarantees would go up. I don't think that we're going to worry about those measurements. Like, it's something like Western Conference Finals or something. Like, there were a bunch of like small ways in which it could be longer. Where his third year would be would raise up in value. As of right now, it's like $10 million buyout. So they would just basically decline his contract, and then the declining of the contract would come with a $10 million check to DeMar.
Got it.
And so that works for another team as well. And so let's just, for example, say there's another team out there that has a player that's, you know, 26 years old. It's on a 3-year, $75 million deal. So they owe him 25 and $26 million over the next 3 years. Let's say the Kings trade DeMar to another team. That team could instantly waive DeMar at the end of the year and pay that $10 million and go from owing, you know, I don't know what it would be. It'd be like $40 million over the 2 years to, well, owing $75 million for the players they had to more like, you know, $35
million. Yeah.
And so you could save another team a bunch of money in a transaction like that. Even, you know, again, as long as you traded him at this deadline, I think that's or before the new basketball season starts, when his contract would have to be guaranteed, that's when you can actually do this type of move. And you know, it would save another team, you know, $16 million off their books too.
Did you think when the collective bargaining agreement was signed that these new aprons would have such a dramatic impact on the league and the way that teams do business as they have?
No, I don't think anybody did. Like, because they've tried things throughout the course of time with
The Recap Show is an unfiltered inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.
The CBA. And the funny thing is, the league always hardlines against the players, and it's always like a battle until last time, right? Like, Adam Silver was able to get through without a stoppage, which David Stern almost like embraced all the time. You know, like every 7 years he'd reset his league, and I never agreed with that either. So we have like the 98 lockout. We got, I think there is one around 2005. You had the 2011 lockout, but you know, now we have labor, you know, like, I don't know what you want to call it, tranquility. But I don't think it's going to last, especially after what just happened. Where, you know, the players have an impound account where 10% of their pay goes into a giant bank account. And the assumption was they would get that money back and maybe some more after that. And that's not what happened.
They lost it all.
The players lost all of it. And now we're seeing an off season where it's very awkward and very weird, and nobody's able to maneuver at all. But I always found it interesting that, you know, the league is the owners. It's backed by the owners, right? They're fighting for ownership, and then the players association is fighting for the players. And the league is always beating up the players. And then as soon as they get the deal done, the owners turn around and circumvent the rules that they just put in place in order to make their teams really good and so a certain group of owners always just instantly go out and spend the money that really was fighting for them not to spend.
Right.
And it's this perpetual cycle. I think at this point, though, everyone is looking around and saying, okay, these rules so extreme that not being able to trade your first round pick is one thing. Losing your first round pick is another. All of a sudden the repeater tax, if you start, you know, doing this 2 or 3 years in a row, you start jumping up to, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars in fines, basically. And even what we saw today with the Bradley Beal buyout, Bradley Beal gave back $13.8 million, and that wasn't him being generous. The only way they could do that deal, gave that money back, because you're only allowed to stretch provision 15% of your salary cap each year. So, but like, just think of it this way. They just basically tied up $20 of their $200 million, you know, around salary cap for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
They can't access that money. They can't do anything with that money. But in return, Damian, that $30 million they saved this year off their books, because that's what it is, you know, 50, and then you spread his contract out over 5 years, you save $30 million bucks. That might save the Suns $100 million in luxury tax.
Yeah, and allows them access to things they weren't going to have access to in terms of picks, in terms of, you know, even the types of players they can sign, the restrictions of the second apron.
Yeah, the second apron, even the first apron is so restrictive, but the second apron is crazy. And again, like, I think teams right now, like the Kings did it last year, and, you know, they hard capped themselves by doing the DeMar DeRozan trade. They, again, hard capped themselves this year by doing the Dennis Schroeder trade. So the Kings are hard capped at the first apron. It's almost intentional. That's it does a way where it's like, nope, well, we're not going to go up there anyways, but in case we needed any further deterrence, here it is. Like, the league will not allow us to go above $188 million this year. And that's just like a really interesting way that they've done business the last 2 years. And like, look, the free agent market hasn't always been good to the Kings. But the sign and trade market might still be okay, because if you're a team that's willing to pay more than other teams for a player, they might be willing to go to play for you in that situation, especially because of the aprons, because, you know, there aren't a bunch of teams out there that can afford these players. So again, the reason why Kuminga isn't signed as a free agent right now is because no one has any money. And, you know, like, if a team has money, they've got the $14.1 million mid-level exception, and that's not enough money for him. So now he's just stuck in this holding pattern until they find some sort of solution with another team, because Golden State doesn't appear to want to pay that money either. So it's just a really, really interesting way that the league is running right now and how difficult it is to move pieces.
Golden State doesn't want to pay a penny to that man, period. Whether it involves their apron, their first, second salary cap, nothing. They don't want to pay nothing to him. I was one. I have the apron tracker, and it's pretty crazy. At 36-46, Phoenix Suns were the most expensive team in the league. That's obviously changed today, or I assume that has changed today with the buyout of Bradley Beal. But I am looking to see. It feels like with the restrictions of the second apron, and as they get greater as you move along, we will likely never see a multi-year second apron team.
Oh,
the restrictions would be far too great. You would just be stuck. Like, your team would literally be in cement.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't even make a trade that brings back a player that makes a dollar over the player that's going out. And I think they limit the ability to aggregate players in a trade. It becomes like really, really, really difficult. And that's where, like, again, we talked about this before, but like, I thought the Knicks were so short-sighted by firing Tom Thibodeau, because what they did last offseason was so aggressive to go out and get Kat, to go out and get Mikal Bridges.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, to pay OG Anunoby all that money and his extension, and to just keep, you know, keeping that team together and paying all the money. Even, you know, he took less money, but why am I drawing a blank? Oh, Jalen Brunson. Jalen Brunson took less money, but he still took a ton of money.
Yeah.
Right? And that contract, all of those contracts were kicking in, but it was like, hey, if you just wait until the offseason, there's going to be like three or four players who are excellent players, but in the twilight of their career that wouldn't mind coming and playing for you. And so you go from a team that has, you know, five players, maybe six, to a team that all of a sudden they filled up their bench and, you know, they were able to go get Yaboselli. They might be able to get Ben Simmons. They were able to get Jordan Clarkson. Like, these are pieces that are so incredibly valuable to a team that Tom Thibodeau couldn't do last summer. And now this summer, Mike Brown is going to be able to take advantage of. Mm-hmm. But again, it's about managing like the top end of your roster and then being able to still field a competent team, because that was the flaw to the Knicks last year. They just straight up ran out of gas late in the season. And part of that's because Thibodeau plays all of his starters, you know, 40 minutes every single night. But a lot of it is just because his team wasn't good enough once he got past the top five. And so now we're going to see a different version of that and maybe a much better team, but certainly a team that's either going to be at the apron or around the, you know, the second apron, but they can stay under that by bringing in veterans who, again, keep this in mind. This is, you pay a veteran who's been in the league 10 years, you pay him $3.6 million, but per league rule, he counts as a league minimum player at $2 million. So mm-hmm. sort of the Alex Len thing that we talked about last mm-hmm. year. So as far as luxury tax dollars, those players count for 2/3 basically of their salary. And that's how you're able to fill up a roster on a great team. It's how the Warriors were able to stay so relevant for so long with budget players around their great players.
You brought up the New York Knicks. I don't know why I find this so funny, but the New York Knicks are $53,000 away from the second apron. And again, I don't know why that's funny to me, but it very much is. And you are absolutely correct. When you are over the second apron, you cannot aggregate two or more player salaries in a trade. You can't send out cash in a trade. And acquiring a player using a TPE that was created via previous sign and trade, you can't do that either. The only things you can do when you're over the second apron is you can re-sign your own free agents, you can sign draft picks, you can sign players to minimum contracts, or you can make trades where one player is sent out an equal or less salary comes back.
And if you're over the second apron, they freeze your the final pick. So it would be the 2032 pick. If you're over the second apron a second time, I believe you forfeit that pick. Yeah, it's crazy. So freezing the pick means you can't trade it.
Yeah.
So right. A team like Denver right now, who literally walked into this offseason with no second round picks and they had no access to any of their own picks. Every pick all of their first round picks were either traded or had trade whatchamacallits on them, the option to swap, mm-hmm. Pick swaps picks on them, like all of their picks. So if they're over the second apron and we hit the new calendar year and they get their 2032 pick, but it's frozen, now they can't trade that either. They can't do anything with it. It really does just make it extremely difficult to maneuver. And I think that some of this will go away because, you know, in the end, even the lower end teams, even if they're not winning, the lower end teams are still like, hey, go ahead and let Joe Lacob spend $300 million. We're okay splitting the tax money. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, they will make adjustments down the road, but for right now, yeah, it's tough.
I think this includes all of the new money and latest deals. The four teams over the first apron are the Nuggets, Lakers, Bucks, and Knicks. The three teams over the second apron are the Boston Celtics, the Minnesota Timberwolves, and the Phoenix Suns. I believe Phoenix is now not only below the second apron, but also below the first apron after the Bradley Beal buyout today, which puts just the Boston Celtics and the Minnesota Timberwolves over the second apron right now.
And how far over the luxury tax was Phoenix before today?
Phoenix
luxury tax
today,
is 198, right?
Over the luxury tax. I have them $25 million over the second apron, $36 million over the first apron. I'm not sure how far that puts them over the luxury tax. Let me do some.
Just add another.
My guess, they were 42. About. If I'm doing this right, were they about $80 million over?
Yeah, that's so much money in luxury tax.
Oh my God,
that's so much money in we're talking $200 million in luxury tax, and that's that's what you're gonna see from a team like Minnesota. Minnesota's gonna pay out the ears for that team. I mean, that is such an expensive team. So, and that's why, you know, they lost Alexander Walker, but also why the Nas Reed transaction was like, oh, that's a lot of money. You just took on another $10 million. That's so much money.
Well, remember that 12-hour period where we thought Rudy Gobert was getting traded?
Oh, yeah.
He posted the what looked like an Instagram goodbye, and I feel like it was Kevin Durant. I think it involved KD, and everyone thought KD was going to Minnesota. As a matter of fact, I think Eddie told us the deal that had KD going to Minnesota. It did involve, I think it was Rudy Gobert, Dante DiVincenzo, and maybe some draft capital. But that has nothing to do with the Sacramento Kings Summer League team being 4-0, and it has nothing to do with the fact that James Hamm has to go. Thanks for joining us an hour early, Hammer. We appreciate you. We'll come back. We'll talk more Kings basketball. We'll talk more NBA basketball. We'll talk more Summer League championship, because it's on the way here for you Kings on Sacramento Sports Leader ESPN 1320.
The Recap Show is an unfiltered inside look into the world of global soccer and women's sports.
Follow and listen to The Recap Show wherever you get your podcasts.